I did my second cup this morning, and that's what I need to make me human, and we're going to be all fine.
Good morning.
All right.
How are you?
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you all?
Good.
So I see some familiar faces here.
Yeah. We never leave. We just stay here.
But you camp out here at the Four Seasons. We don't leave. You've been here for a lot of years.
We just stay. You know, we go, this is nice.
This is nice.
I can do this.
Room service? Yeah. But who's picking up that tab?
Yeah.
Oh.
So can you talk a little bit about how you got involved? Was, you know, were you familiar with the story? Or
I was surprisingly quite unfamiliar with the story. I think most of us are, which is shocking if you consider that it is to date one of the largest busts ever, you know, put on record. Brad Furman has been a longtime friend of mine. In point of fact, I knew Brad when he was a kid. He was the 19-year-old assistant to my agent at ICM in New York when I was working on Law and Order back in the 90s. And he used to run scripts down to me on the set at Chelsea Piers, kind of wet behind the ears, you know, very enthusiastic. Who knew that he would grow up into this very insightful, skilled, thoughtful director? I'm super proud of what he's accomplished in his time as a director, obviously starting with The Lincoln Lawyer, but this is a kind of masterpiece for him. He's yet young, and yet he, I think, has clearly demonstrated to all of us that he's got so much potential, at yet still untapped.
So did you have to audition for this, or is this all...
Yes, the bastard. Can you believe he made me audition? No, of course not.
No. Nepotism
at its finest. Of course. You know, one of the many things I appreciate about Brad is he's deeply loyal, and that's obviously one of the themes we explore in the film. But he's worked with Yul Vasquez quite a few times. He's worked with John Leguizamo. Brian was in Lincoln Lawyer. So what you have here is a pattern of mutual respect and that loyalty playing out in a professional scenario. Who doesn't want to work with people that they respect and like? We all do.
Isn't that more about creating a tribe rather than some kind of loyalty where people want to know, people feel that much more comfortable with the people they work with and they create a tribe ensemble?
Well, comfortability is an aspect of the desire to create a tribe like that, but you also have to be entirely trusting of what their abilities are and have a firm belief that they can deliver what it is you expect of them. And so, you know, it's not like he gave me the role because he thought I was a nice guy or, you know, due to our personal history. In a way, he courted me. I had done a number of jobs where, you know, I've walked in similar territory, and I was reluctant on some level to step into the role of yet another cartel leader. Mm-hmm. But the thing that convinced me to take the role on ultimately was that he was very interested in showing an aspect of the humanness of a person like this. That, in fact, although he sees his business as from a perspective of mere practicality, it's a matter of supply and demand, his individual actions have consequences. And we see that exists for Bob Mazur as well, Brian's character, that while you're achieving your agenda, taking down a criminal, there's fallout all around you. And in both cases, I think these men on some level are mirror images of each other. They expect of themselves and seek within others that they want to have close within their social circles a kind of integrity, a kind of principle, which begets a trustworthiness. And that's why they're drawn to each other. But through their actions, through their choices on how they conduct themselves, there's oftentimes collateral damage. And in both cases, they're both family men, they're both loyal, but there's fallout on both sides with their respective loved ones.
What was your research process like?
Well, for one, you start with the book. Mm-hmm. And the book the screenplay is based upon is a kind of bible of thrilling factual information on what really went down. The real Bob Mazur is a fantastic raconteur. I don't know if you guys are going to get a chance to talk with him, but mm-hmm. his memory is practically photographic. and the way he tells it. And, you know, it's a, it can make for very dry reading, you know, hearing about all the bureaucracy and the hoops they have to jump through. But when you get right down to the nitty-gritty of what he did, how deeply undercover he went to pull off this operation, it's nothing less than thrilling. And it seemed like such an obvious choice to translate to film, and it's surprising to me that it took so long. I think the book came out in 2010. And it's so cinematic in nature, so when you actually see it rendered in the film, almost to the point, it seems unbelievable.
Like,
that's a cinematic device, isn't it? That they would, this whole thing would culminate in a staged wedding where they arrested 85 people. Like, who's going to buy that? Yeah. It really happened.
That was very unique. Mm. I've never seen that on screen before. How much a character direction did you get from Brad?
Well, beyond, you know, a kind of a him sharing his feelings with how he wanted to bring a kind of honesty and, as we already talked about, humanity to the character. What I found incredibly helpful was, in addition to the material I've sourced from the book, personal stories that were shared with me by Bob Mazur. But the real ace in the hole for me was the actual secret recordings he provided to me of meetings he had with Al Caino. And though I didn't have access at the time to any of the photographs or any video images of what this man looked like, to this day I don't think I have a really solid idea of what this gentleman looks like, I got a clear picture of how I wanted to play him, from listening to his voice, to the gregariousness of his nature, to the inherent charm of how he communicated about anything, from something as mundane to the meal he had the night before, to, you know, when the baby is going to be delivered in Philadelphia, his girlfriend's about to deliver the baby. Of course, that's all secret code talk for, there's a drug shipment that's going to arrive any day now. I need to be here and looking after my girlfriend. So that proved invaluable to me, probably the most valuable of all of it. And, you know, for all of the charm and sophistication and worldliness that he exhibits, Brad and I always wanted to make sure that there's always the presence of danger, because this, for all of his charm, this man was truly a dangerous man.
How dangerous was he?
Well, he was one of the top lieutenants within the Escobar cartel.
He was a murderer too?
It's all there on public record. What I do know is that he had direct contact with the board members of the Medellin cartel, and you just have to, you know, have a general idea what happens within that scope of business to imagine some of the things that go on.
So I understand and appreciate you're an actor and it's what's meaty to you, but you made this guy so freaking likable.
Is that right?
I love it.
And so human. The biggest laugh in the theater was when his daughter was like, wow. Yeah. I mean, who can't relate to that? So on a whole other level, do you think, God, I made this guy really likable.
Well, it is a bit of a conundrum, because his actions, the world of his particular kind of business has a real ugliness. It's, you know, it's power and violence and murder and mayhem and menace. And yet I thought it was a mistake as an actor to prejudge or predetermine, if you will, whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. You can't go into any characterization with that opinion or attitude or approach, because it's sudden death. What it will convey ultimately is a one-dimensional character, a black-hatted figure who, you know, you've seen countless times. What I was more interested in, and it fell in line with obviously what Brad's desire was as a director, was to make him far more complex. And that's there on the page, thankfully. I mean, the quality that you speak of is there written. And I thought it was more interesting to sort of highlight those qualities. I had to find something lovable or something I could appreciate as a person in this person. And what we all discover in watching the film is that he possesses a slew of qualities that we all wish for ourselves and actually seek out in our social circles. He's a loyal friend. He's a man of faith. He's a devoted family man. He's a loving husband and a father, a very successful and charming businessman. What's not to like? He's engaged in criminal activity, and he's quite dangerous. But even that, he has a kind of twisted logic in terms of how he rationalizes that. This is an issue of supply and demand. I wouldn't be what I am unless America made me this way. I didn't force drugs on anyone. You all want drugs, I'm the man to supply them. I could be sweating my balls off in a restaurant somewhere, he says, but this is a smarter choice for me. So, as we say, that's twisted logic, but in a way, you have to recognize that these are little personal justifications he makes to engage in what he does, but otherwise he's doesn't seem like that bad of a guy. And as I said, he's kind of a mirror image of Brian's character. They're in similar dilemma, if you will. Their business life is almost like a separate entity from their personal life. But Brian's character too is a family man. He gets into a situation where there's potential danger for his family as well.
Talking about the likable and family man, so you yourself has a daughter, so in this one, your character has a daughter, and I can see that like a father and the daughter is a teenager.
Yes.
Daughter is having a little bit, you know, distance from the parents. And how are yourself as a father in your life? How do you deal with your daughters?
Well, that parallel for me was quite easy because I am a shamelessly doting father. I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. I'm in love with both of them as much as I am in love with my wife. And it takes a lot to get me up in the morning now to go to work. I have to be honest. I fantasize about retiring.
But,
no! But I don't think that's at all possible, because you got to put food on the table. I love working. I love actors, and I love creating with other creative, talented people. But being a family man, being there for them in these years that are irreplaceable, I've seen too much fallout from too many other families where one parent or the other has made the decision for one reason or another, not to be judged, to not be there. And the result often is not pretty. And so I want my kids to grow up with the memory of actually having me there most days. And so far we've been very lucky. It's been a decade or more in each case. And I've been very fortunate to be away for only short spurts of time and spend most of the time with them.
What's the craziest thing you ever did in a movie?
Oh, boy.
Or either it hit your I'm never going to be doing that again list.
Well,
this is totally fun, and I'm absolutely going to do
the this. Craziest thing I ever did in a movie was in a film called Piñero,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where I had one friend. This is all within the realm of the film. This is not real life. shooting me up with cocaine, another shooting me with heroin in this arm, while getting a blowjob from an unnamed woman. So I had three sensory experiences going at once, if you will. That's not a normal day in my house, nor is it a normal day in any working environment I've ever been in before or since, so that probably qualifies as the craziest thing I've ever done on film.
Now, which list did that
go on? Someone showed me a clip of that out of context recently, the director of that film, my dear friend Leonie Chasso. I think for a moment he posted it on his Instagram, and I said, what the fuck are you doing? Like, that's positively pornographic out of context. Please remove that. And he did.
Yeah. That was a passion project for you. So have you come across something else that is, giving you kind of an instinct to just go for it and do it? I mean, not necessarily to that degree, but is there something else that you'd like to do to direct or write? Or
I really love performing, and while I have such an appreciation for directing, and while within any given scene I'm working on with another actor or a director, I can sense if something's wrong or off, and I might have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
I fancy that I might have an idea on how to fix things. I don't believe I possess the overall scope it takes to direct or to steer a narrative from beginning, middle to end. Mm-hmm. It's a huge responsibility, and you really have to answer to 100 people or more at any given moment. And having watched my brother do it, and other friends of mine, including Brad, do it, it's stressful. You know, I want to keep my hair.
Was there one scene in the film that was particularly difficult and wasn't working?
No, actually. You know, the one thing that I'm really happy about, having seen the film now only once, is that it does have a very international, grand feel to it. But that being said, it's likely no secret that, you know, we have limitations in terms of budget and locations and all the various things that accompany independent filmmaking. So time was not a luxury, and that's what actors need more than anything, is time and space to create. And so oftentimes you're thrown right into it and you have to sort of do it on the fly. There was not a lot of rehearsal time. The good news is when you're working alongside someone like Brian, and most of my stuff was with Brian, and Diane Kruger, and Amy Ryan, and Yul Vasquez, and John Leguizamo. These are folks at the top of their game. They're all up to it. They're all ready for it. And the best advice that Brad Furman gave me before we started shooting, he said, look, you're going to meet Brian, and you're going to be charmed by how kind and how sweet he is, and he is all of those things. He's genuinely one of the nicest men you're ever going to want to meet. But don't be lulled into it, because he is a heavyweight fighter and he's going to come out swinging. So do not show up and kind of, you know, walk through it and think it's going to be like a cakewalk. It's not. So I really took that to heart. Maybe even scared me a little bit, because that's Walter White we're talking about. The result, I think, is something that I'm actually pretty proud of.
Would you like to comment on the election at all?
No, I'm here to talk about the movie.
Okay.
I think a lot of what's going on speaks for itself.
Benjamin, I think the last time we spoke was for La Mission.
Oh, yeah.
And you had a lot of passion for that film.
Right.
And I see you're having the same passion for this film. Yeah.
That's an interesting observation. I wouldn't disagree with you. I think my personal passion comes out when I'm associated with projects that have, beyond just the work, have an element of love to them. Brad, I see you as someone who's almost like my kid brother, and John and Yul are part of that circle too. We all sort of came up in the 90s together. But beyond that, to have an opportunity where you're, again, working alongside people who share a similar life perspective or perspective on the artistic process, those don't often come around. And La Mission, I'm so happy that you mentioned that, because to your question, that remains unequal to Pinheiro in terms of the opportunity afforded me as a performer. You know, these kinds of roles, they don't come along often for me. I've done a whole slew of different things over the course of years. But something where you have an opportunity to bring complexity or three-dimensionality to someone is not often the case, especially as a man of color. So, you have to seize upon them and celebrate them.
Was there one seminal moment when you knew you had to act? Last question. Did you hear the question?
No.
Was there a seminal moment when you knew you had to act, that you wanted to be an actor?
I just remember the first time I got on stage. I auditioned on a lark for the high school production at my dad's encouragement, because my grandfather, George Bratt, was a member of the Grand Street Follies on Broadway. He worked with James Cagney, so it was part of the family lore that acting's in our blood, and no one ever really bought that. But I have to confess that the moment I stepped on stage and I was playing the villain, I think it was the devil in Daniel Webster, I was playing the devil. I just felt a surge of energy and creativity and I don't know how else to describe it, electricity that I had never felt before, not from sports, not from academics, not from anything else. And I thought, okay, maybe I should check this out, give it a shot.
Bravo.
And here you are.
Still. Thank you. All right, guys.
Thanks, Benjamin.
Cheers.
Thank you so much. Oh, here, I got it for you.